A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on August 8, 1999, in the series Good News, Then and Now, entitled When God Fails Our Expectations. The texts for the sermon are Isaiah 2, verses 1 through 4, 2 Peter 3, verses 1 through 13, and Matthew 24, verses 29 through 35. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
I begin this morning a new series of messages, a rather ambitious undertaking which will bring us to Reformation Sunday on October 31. There will be a few interruptions, but by and large, we are going to be dealing with the theme, Good News, Then and Now. I thought that it might be appropriate for us to be concentrating on this as we move toward Reformation Sunday, because it'll be Reformation Sunday 1999 on the threshold of the third millennium, and certainly an appropriate time in which to be thinking about our faith, how it might be revisioned, how it might be reimagined, in order that it might have a fresh sound and be compelling for the people of our generation and into the future. And following Reformation Sunday, we'll have a wonderful opportunity. The Jewish Christian Dialogue Committee will bring Amy Jill Levine in from Vanderbilt Divinity School, a Jewish scholar who teaches Christian origins. And she'll be speaking here on November 7th. And the following weekend, the second weekend in November, will be Bishop John Shelby Spong, who will be speaking to us on the subject, Why Christianity Must Change or Die. And so my intention in this series is to prepare us for Reformation and the challenge that will come to us in those subsequent weeks. We are children of the Reformation. I am. This congregation in its roots is, although it's interesting, the largest contingent of people, I think, who have joined Christ Community over the last decade have come from the Roman Catholic tradition. But nonetheless, Protestantism has become, after the Reformation of the 16th century, one of the major families of Christian faith. And as we think about the Reformation of the Church in the 16th century, we recognize that there have been major shifts, at least that major shift in faith understanding, and that major shift had tremendous institutional implications as well. But what I hope that we will see in this series of messages is that it was not only in the 16th century when there was such a major shift in faith understanding, but that rather faith understanding has been developing over 2,000 years. It has always been going on. It necessarily always must go on. And I think if we are to have the freedom to engage in that in our own day, in our own way, we need to know that we stand in a long line of those who have worked at understanding the faith and finding for it a fresh expression that resonates with the experience of every new generation. That probably sounds like an apology for my ministry, apology in the sense of defense or explanation, giving a reason for the hope that is in me. But it really is also an apology for the posture of this congregation. And so we're going to begin. And I want you to know that I had entitled this, as I thought about it and worked at it and really wrestled with it, I had entitled this series, Christian Faith and the Climate of Opinion, a 2,000-year retrospective. Peter said, wow, that's impressive, but no one will come. And so then I said, well, Christian faith and historical development. And Colette said, boring. And then I thought something which says it, and is almost poetic for me. When symbols break and myths dissolve. And Peter and Colette said, scary. So I've come to the mundane title, Good News, Then and Now. But of course you get the same stuff anyway. But now it won't feel quite so heavy for summer Sundays. The faith has been developing for 2,000 years. And the purpose of the translation of that faith is that good news might sound. The good news, which is a translation of gospel. The gospel is good news. It's good news. Because it's the story of the coming to us of the God full of grace, whose love embraces us, in whom we can trust, in whom our soul can rest. And it's news because it's constantly updated. That is, it becomes relevant and meaningful with every turn of the corner of history's unfolding. Good news then. Good news now. And in order to demonstrate the fact that this has been an ongoing process from the beginning, I now go back to the 16th century. I'm going to go back to the first century and begin by showing you that there was already a crisis of faith and a subsequent transformation of the faith in the first century. I don't need to belabor the point that the whole New Testament, from beginning to end, is posited on the hope and the assurance of the imminent return of Jesus Christ from heaven in power and glory to judge the living and the dead. We repeat it in the Creed, which goes way on back, although it had some development over the centuries. But we read it all over the Bible. We read it this morning. But beyond what we read this morning, for example, St. Paul writing to the church at Thessalonica, which he had founded, giving them this hope of the imminent appearing of Jesus. And then loved ones began to die. And they were upset, worrying that those who died would miss out on it all. So Paul wrote to them in the 4th chapter of his first letter, the 13th verse following, I write to you, brothers and sisters, that you sorrow not as those who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, then even so those who fall asleep in Jesus, God will bring with him. And we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will not have an advantage over those who have died. So comfort one another with these words. And when he was writing his great resurrection chapter in the 15th of 1 Corinthians, he says at one point, we shall not all die, but we shall all be changed, for flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of heaven. And of course, we have the words of Jesus in the gospel reading this morning, concluding with, this generation will not pass away until all of these things have taken place. Now, let me be clear that probably Jesus didn't say that. At least it's a rigorous debate today amongst the Jesus scholars as to whether that was Jesus or whether that was the community post-Easter, but that isn't particularly important. My point here is that the whole New Testament, throughout the Gospels, the letters, the last book of the New Testament, the revelation of Jesus Christ to John, how does it conclude? Just before that final benediction, the words of the ascended Lord, surely I am coming soon. That was the expectation. And the whole Jesus movement that was in the beginning a Jewish Jesus movement, but subsequently through the missionary activity of St. Paul became a Gentile Christian movement. The whole movement, the Jewish element in Jerusalem and environs, the Gentile element scattered throughout Asia Minor and Europe, all of them believed the good news of Jesus, of his life, his death, his resurrection, enthronement, and his imminent coming again. And imminent is the operative word. Not just a fuzzy, well, sometime, surely, but it was imminent. It was to be very soon. They lived in expectancy that any moment the Lord of glory would appear in the clouds in power, and that there would be the consummation of all things, the judging of the living and the dead, the general resurrection, and the end. That was the staple plank of the gospel platform. And then, of course, nothing happened. Jesus did not return. The heavens did not part. The Lord of glory did not come. That was the first major crisis of the faith tradition, which has become the Christian tradition, now 2,000 years old. That was a major crisis. It's not hard to understand that. There was an expectation. There had been a new world born in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Those who were baptized into Christ were baptized into a new creation. Old things had passed away, all things were made new, and it would all come to its final consummation imminently. And it didn't happen. It was one thing for Paul to write to Thessalonica and say, relax about your loved ones who have died, because all who are part of this terminal generation will share that great event. But what when that whole apostolic generation dies? What when that whole generation that was to be the terminal generation passes away? That's a crisis. A very deep and traumatic crisis, a crisis of faith. And in the light of that crisis, there were various responses. Many fell away. Others mocked. In fact, the second letter of Peter, which was not written by Peter. It was written too late for it to have been a letter of Peter. There are enough indications within the letter itself that we know that probably the earliest that it could have been written would have been 90 in the Common Era, and it may be, it's dated by many, as late as 150. So we're talking about anywhere from 70 to 120 years after the event of Jesus Christ. And we can read the crisis off this letter, because Peter addresses this issue head on. He said, scoffers will arise, and they'll mockingly say, well, where's the promise of his appearing? And then they would put the knife in and twist it by adding, all things continue like they have from the creation. A colloquial translation of which would be business as usual. What's the big deal? You've hung your hope on a false premise. Nothing happened. The writer of this letter was encouraging people to hang on. He was pleading with them not to despair, not to give up their hope, not to give up their faith. He reminded them that as far as God is concerned, 1,000 years is like a day. And a day like 1,000 years. He reminds them that God created the earth out of waters and then destroyed the earth with waters. And now has recreated an earth which will be destroyed by fire in an awful judgment at the end. So he says, hang on and live in all godliness and holiness, ready when it happens. That letter tells us that within the emerging Christian community, this was indeed a crisis. But not all mocked in light of the delay of the parousia. That's the technical term, the delay of the parousia. Parousia is from a Greek word which means advent or appearing. And the delay of the parousia, that means like when you go to the ticket counter at the airport and they say there'll be a 10-minute delay. You go back in 10 minutes and it's a 20-minute delay. You go back in 20 minutes and it's now a half hour, and 5 hours later, delay is a softening word. It was the delay. Don't give up on this. It's going to happen. Hang tough. Delay only. Not talking about postponement. Delay. The delay of the parousia created the first great crisis for the faith, and there were those who scoffed, but there are others who were serious because they had experienced something of the reality of the grace of God in Jesus Christ. They had seen something in one like St. Paul, and they said, we have to rethink this thing because what we're dealing with here is a deep reality, but our timetable seems to be wrong, or the scaffolding which supports the structure is out of kilter. And so they began to wrestle with the meaning of Jesus Christ in a world that was not ending. The meaning of the gospel in terms of living in history that seems to be ongoing. Now, how do I translate the Christ event, the proclamation of good news by the Apostle Paul, how do I translate that in a situation that has changed? My changing historical context demands of me to find some different perspective, some new understanding of this faith which has touched me in the depths of my being. And so they began to work at it. And it was out of that reworking that the Christian gospel was transformed. It was transformed in what those who deal with these things speak of as the early Catholic tradition. What emerged from this struggle and wrestling in the crisis was the early Catholic tradition. That translation meant that the Jewish Christian community faded and finally was simply wiped out. But the Gentile Christian mission founded by St. Paul found enough continuity in the translation, although St. Paul's understanding had to be transformed. Nonetheless, there was enough continuity so that there was an ongoing sense of gospel, and we have the early Catholic tradition. It was a struggle. They were all over the place. There were groups and sects and divisions and different locales, different geographical areas understood the gospel differently. There was great conflict and tension, and there was confrontation. But finally, out of it all, there emerged this early Catholic tradition, which involved dogma. This was the birth of orthodoxy. Now the faith had come together, coalesced, and this is now the creed. And that's heresy. That's where that was born too. And there was also the development of the worship of the church, liturgical forms, rituals, prayers, etc., reflecting that orthodox faith. And then, of course, there was the structure of the church. The institution itself now took form. So out of the crisis that stemmed from the fact that Jesus did not come, emerged the early Catholic tradition. And as a matter of fact, there's a Latin phrase that describes the consensus of Christian faith. It's called the regula fidei, the regulation of faith, or the order of faith. And the crisis was moved beyond through the transformation and fresh understanding of what had come to expression in Jesus Christ. Now there was good news. Again, because they had found a way to experience the grace of God in Christ in a different historical circumstance, which belied their initial expectation. That's, I think, quite obvious when you stop to think about it. How critical that must have been. How scary that must have been. And yet, what came out of it was this grand institution, which we'll be talking about in subsequent weeks. But the church was born in a crisis of faith, and that marked the first transformation of the understanding of the gospel. Albert Schweitzer was the one who called attention to biblical scholars at the turn of this century that it was that apocalyptic expectation of the imminent return of Jesus that was the womb out of which all of the rest of Christian dogma evolved. Christian dogma in that early phase was a statement of the faith in the light of an expectation that was not realized. So what? Well, so if on the threshold of the third millennium we find it incumbent upon us to find a fresh expression for the faith, we stand in a tradition that's 2,000 years old. If in our historical context, if in our understanding of the evolutionary development of cosmic reality, of the human story, human history, if that late-breaking reality that keeps exploding before our eyes and understanding calls our faith conceptions into question, there's no need to fear, but rather to say, well, if God is that big, if the world is that big, if reality is that of that magnitude, then how do I understand Jesus Christ? Then how do I speak good news in the light of that which came to expression in Jesus? And the purpose of my making you muddle through all of this is to help you to see that that in which we are engaged is an old story that needs constantly to be repeated and to be reenacted. But I'm amazed at the fact that in that 2,000-year development, there still are voices that sound just like 2 Peter. 2 Peter, the author of 2 Peter, was the first fundamentalist. A fundamentalist is simply one who reiterates yesterday's answers to today's questions. And yesterday's Grand Rapids Press has a very nice large picture of a TV evangelist who has written a book, who was in Grand Rapids this week, is signing his book. The book is From Daniel to Doomsday. The countdown has begun. Looking for the millennial turn and sounding forever like the author of 2 Peter. He said he is spreading the gospel of Jesus Christ and telling people what the Bible says about the terminal generation. I find it fascinating. The first crisis of the faith was the fact that the terminal generation turned out not to be terminal. But now, books are being written and purchased by one who claims that this is the terminal generation. This week I got a catalog from Christian Book Distributors, and on the back is a series of novels. I guess they're novels. It's called the Left Behind series. Left behind in the terms of when the rapture comes and the believers are taken out of the world, that's the rapture. Some speak of it as a rupture, but it's technically the rapture. Then those who are left have hell to pay. And these are scary books. The sixth volume has now been written. Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins' Left Behind series, six volumes. You can get them at the bookstore for $134.92 or discounted here for $88.50, all six of them. They are selling in the millions. They are selling in the millions, which makes me wish I didn't have so much intellectual integrity. The centerfold of this catalog has seven titles about the Y2K crisis. Family Survival Guide, The Road to Armageddon, Jesus' Final Warning. And I wonder if no one ever told these people that the church went through this 2,000 years ago. This quaking before the imminent return of the Lord from glory. It is fascinating to me. The theological, biblical ignorance combined with economic exploitation and the abuse of people through the imputation of guilt and the exciting of fear. That really is criminal. And it belies a knowledge of the whole development of 2,000 years of Christian history. But I suppose that will always be the case. And perhaps at this advanced age, I should no longer be surprised at it. But why is it important to deal with this? Because the painful crisis of the first century believers, that crisis of faith, was a crisis of God failing to meet their expectations. God failed their expectations. They were expecting this glorious redemption, and nothing happened. And my pastoral concern is that we not create false expectations that whittle God down to size, make God like a magic genie. The pulpit often promises far too much, promises that cannot be delivered. And then expectations are shattered. And the danger is that one will give up, lose hope, despair of God. If God is made into a human-sized idol and then set forth as one who can be bent to my little personal needs and agendas, to my fears and my insecurities, that God, sometime or other, will fail our expectations. And I think that is a very critical matter. I've been a pastor long enough to know the flowers today celebrate, remember, 6-year-old Lydia, for whom prayers were offered and everything possible and medical science was done. And I've been with you enough to know that I dare not promise you what I cannot produce. That is to make a God who is a Mr. or Mrs. Fix-It. God calls us to maturity. God calls us to responsibility. God calls us to grow up, to realize that we must live responsibly, taking responsibility for our lives and for our world. What we need to be able to do is to see through Paul, to see through the limitations of that structure of history and understanding that he had, to see through Paul, to see the grace that transformed Paul, to know that that first apostolic generation that had experienced the presence of God in Jesus Christ, had experienced the presence of God in Jesus Christ, which was not synonymous with their knowledge of everything else about the physical world and the course of history. What we have to be able to do is recognize that in this ongoing story that was never anticipated in the initial expression of the gospel, there is a picture and understanding, there is a vision that's so much larger and bigger than anything the biblical people ever could have possibly conceived of. But what they did experience was the reality of God. Now we need, if we have experienced that same grace, to have the courage then to express that trust in God in light of everything else we know about this marvelous, exciting world that continues to break out before us. And in order to do that, we need to take the biblical word and the theological understanding, the dogmatic statement, and keep translating it, keep saying it again, keep saying it so that the good news then becomes the good news now. Because otherwise, we'll be set up for trauma when we run into the tragedy and the suffering that are part and parcel of being human. The suffering and the tragedy that are not fixed by God, but ought to be fixed by us who are called to rest in God, full of grace, whose purposes of love for the world invite us to follow in the way of Jesus. When God fails our expectations, our expectations are wrong, because our God is too small.